Yo, what's wrong with your laptop right now? Why is it screaming?
I don't know.
Okay, now do a talk.
Do a talk. This is me talking, probably how I'm gonna usually talk.
Okay.
I should probably learn how to talk louder.
You should. Are you ready for some football? Are you ready for some football? Are you ready to record?
Yes.
Okay.
Welcome back to Gumshoe Weekly.
The epicenter of murder, mystery, and football!
Oh my god.
Don't ever expect us to talk about football. We won't.
I won't.
Unless somebody gets murdered during a football game.
I think we spoke about football once, about that very rapey coach.
Oh, Sandusky. Shit. Fuck that dude.
Fuck that guy.
What's your name?
Oh, I'm Brianna.
And I am Juno. I'm a pregnant teenager.
I think you were Juno before, too.
I know, but maybe I was a different one. No one knows.
Fair enough. All right. Well, I have a question.
Okay, great. What's your question?
Would you rather...
You love would you rathers.
I do.
Okay.
Would you rather always feel like you're about to sneeze, or always feel like you're about to poop?
Oh, no.
So many.
Those are both horrible. Because you don't get that orgasmic bliss of sneezing if you don't ever
sneeze. That really truly is better than sex. You're like... But I don't...
Nothing.
Okay, so I think what should be the deciding factor here is it like... Oh, I think I gotta poop, or like, oh my god, I fucking have bubble gut.
I mean? Think that if I felt like I had to poop, that would directly affect all day long, my whole day.
Yeah.
I think if I had to sneeze all day, it would just be me, like, my eyes watering a little bit, like...
That definitely fucks with like, hold on. You.
And they'd be like, you do this every day. I'll go, one day a sneeze will come. One day. And it'll be fucking bliss. Anyways, the poop thing, I think it would... How do you even have sex if you have to poop?
Well, it's not you're going to poop.
You stop. You feel like you stop and you go, let me go poop.
You definitely shouldn't do butt stuff if you feel like you're always going
100%.
Poop.
But also, you're saying you always feel like you have to poop. It doesn't mean you don't poop now. You still poop sometimes.
So you never take a chance?
So when do you know...
What if you do it with a butt plug?
Stop. You're horrible. I don't want to talk anymore. You introduced poop into my life so many times today.
And one of them was me pooping.
Yeah, one of them was you pooping and talking about it a lot. And that was fine. And now it's not.
Do we move on?
I hope so.
Have you seen... You know about the cult, Nexium, right? Like, it was, like, a couple of years ago that she was, like, branded and it came out and it was, like, a whole thing. Because she had a brand on her, kind of, like, close to her pelvic bone, her pubic mound. and the chick from Smallville was, like, in the cult.
And from Smallville?
Yeah. The one who, played, I want to say, Supergirl? Allison Mackey?
Hurt my neck.
Does that sound familiar?
That sounds like a name.
If you saw her, you'd probably know. Okay. If you watched Smallville, I did not. Okay. So, I watched in my quarantine... Well, not my quarantine. I watched after this new documentary. Well, it's not really new, but it's called... Yeah, it is. It came out in 2020. It's called The Vow, and it's about the Nexium cult. Ooh. And the Nexium cult was basically a cult that was... really promoting, like, personal growth. And you know how you're always like, I would never get caught in a fucking cult.
Yeah.
I definitely could see myself getting caught in a fucking cult.
Oh, no.
Because the way that they promoted it... I'll wait.
Don't wait. Go ahead.
So, yeah. So, the way that they promoted the cult was definitely, like... personal growth, transforming your life, and that kind of thing. It's it doesn't sound that bad. Honestly, it really didn't. And then they started opening things within the cult. Like, within that main forum, I guess? That main group, they started branching off and making all these other groups. Mm-hmm. Like, there was one to empower women, there was one to... give really good childcare, that they would, like, teach your kids all these lessons that they needed to know and teach them different languages and all this shit. So it didn't sound that bad. It definitely sounded like something, like, if you had the money, you can get sucked into very easily. One guy had Tourette's, and then he didn't have Tourette's anymore after it.
What?
Yeah.
What?
So, and it was run by this one guy who you're like, that fucking dude is crazy. And these people were, like, infatuated with him. He is extremely smart. Keith Reinhardt, that's his name. Keith Reinhardt.
Oh,
Keith,
I recognize that name.
He was the cult leader, right? Mm-hmm. So, him and a therapist got together, and they were like, we're going to create these programs, and people are going to, there's, like, different steps you can do, and you can open new programs once you become a trainer. The documentary is so good.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically about this woman. It's about these people who got out of the cult. That's what it's about, essentially. Mm-hmm. And it talks about, it leads you all the way, like, it was the main guy, the main guy, Keith, he never really got close to men. Got close to women, and that's what fucking blew up his spot.
Mm.
He was having women. The women created this subsection of the main thing, and were basically recruiting other women to get branded with his initials and them not know it. And basically, they would go on diets, and it was like dominant and submissive, and you would basically become a slave.
Ew.
All in the name of womanhood.
Wow.
So, fuck those women for taking that and making it something gross.
Yeah.
All in the name of a man.
Yeah.
Fuck them. So, he's in jail now, obviously. He got caught. And good. It was basically because this woman, she was a mom, and her daughter was in this cult, and Allison Mackey was in this cult, and if you see her, like, these people were fucking brainwashed. They didn't think that what was going on was wrong. But it was really good. It's called The Vow. That was the point of it. It was called The Vow. And basically, it blew up because women were getting branded and basically being recruited into this sex thing.
Yeah.
That's the whole reason it blew up. And it's crazy because these women were being controlled by a man.
Yeah.
Under this false pretense of, like, women empowerment. And, like, these women had to, like, ask to eat a certain amount of calories and ask to send... Like, oh, I'm going to send this text. Is it okay?
Ew.
Master, is it okay if I do this? So if you want to watch a really good fucking documentary, it's that one.
Yeah.
The main guy, this main guy was really close with Keith, and he was documenting everything. So all these clips are real-time clips of them talking and things that they would say and phone calls that were happening, and he documented everything.
Oh,
and his
God.
Wife was the first one to be like, something fucking fishy's going on here. I'm out. His wife left. And he had brought his wife in. And then it took him a couple years, and then he was like, hold the fuck up. Like, something really fishy is going on here, because women were coming to him and being like, something's going on. I'm, like, women are getting recruited, and it's just, if you want to see a good fucking docu-series, watch it. It's called The Vow. It's okay. On HBO Max, and it was really good.
I'm into it.
Really, really good. I didn't know very much about that cult until I saw that.
And what is it called?
The Vow.
No, the cult.
NXIVM. It's NXIVM.
Wow. Definitely had dyslexia in my head, because I was like, Zoomies.
Zoomies, the shoe store.
The mall.
And if you saw the lady, you would know. She came out with a book called The Scarred.
Who, Allison Mackey?
No, Allison Mackey is wholeheartedly still into that fucking cult. She got jail time, though.
Well, related. So you know how I watched The Rookie, that good cop show? They had an episode about a guy who led a super big cult after starting a acting class. He got everyone, like, he recruited from there, and then they all, like...
Uh-huh.
It was, like, the end of days or whatever. And the cult leader was Freddie Muniz.
Ooh.
And he was crazer.
This is the cover of the book for Scarred.
Ooh.
You saw that picture before, I'm sure.
Uh-uh.
And she has the that's the branding.
And is it his initials?
She was like, it was almost like a 3D picture where it's like, it's, you have to find something in the picture. She was like, it almost came out at me. Ooh. And it was a K-R... And then it was also an AM for Allison Mackey and Keith Reiner.
Why is her name in there?
She was the one who created that DOS. It was called DOS. She created that subsection with him.
She created the sex one?
With him.
With the branding?
To basically recruit women to have sex with him. Because they would Allison go, Mackie. They would go, I can show you pictures of her. They would go, this is Allison Mackie. I don't know if you watched Smallville. I didn't really watch it, but you see the K, K, and then R.
Oh, right? No.
And then A, M. And they were telling these women that this is, it's a women's empowerment. It's the sky and mountains and it shows our growth and all that shit. It's fucking crazy. It's fucking crazy. But the documentary is so good. It came out in 2020. They're coming out with a season 2. And at the end of season 1, you start to see other people who they were talking about in the thing. Almost like they switched loyalty. You should watch it. So good.
I want to watch it. What's it on?
HBO Max. That's where I watched, like, HBO On Demand. I don't know if it's anywhere else. I know there's another documentary because in the main documentary, in The Vow, one of the ladies that, like, really got it out there was a mom whose daughter was in it, and the mom was famous. Mm-hmm. And her daughter was in the cult, and she was just basically trying to get her out.
Ooh.
So she's the one who really kind of put it on the map and, like, used her fame and stuff like that to push, like, hey, my daughter's in a cult.
Okay, before we get started, I need you to eat this.
Eat what?
This.
Dill pickle cashew.
I just opened this, but I will also eat some.
What does it smell like?
It didn't smell like pickles. I thought it would. I smelled it.
It definitely smells like cashews.
It does. There are cashews in that bag. Oh, I would not drink your wine before eating it.
It smells like salt and vinegar chips.
I really like this brand, so we'll see. Oh my god, I dropped one in my crotch.
I'm not mad about it. I would eat these, and I don't like dry nuts.
What the fuck is a wet nut?
Like, I don't like those. Like, I don't eat those. Like, I'm not getting a bag of pistachios or almonds and just chilling and eating almonds and cashews and shit.
They make a really good glazed pecan. Mm. This is not bad.
It's not. It definitely has, like, a salt and vinegar, like, underlining taste.
Once you get the pickle flavor for a second, you're like, I don't like that.
I didn't taste the pickle at all.
I don't hate it. I'll probably eat the entire bag.
It's a good one. I almost wish they had a little bit more of a pickle flavor. Because I don't taste the pickle. I taste the salt and vinegar. It tastes like salt and vinegar chips.
Huh.
I keep laying them on my tongue hoping I'll get more of a fucking salt and vinegar.
It's like the minute it soaks into your tongue, it just turns into...
Cashew.
Cashew. When it's at the ghost of your tongue, you're like, ooh.
Yeah.
Who's she? I do like dry nuts.
Maybe as an adult, it might be a new acquired taste.
And when are you planning on... being an adult.
No time soon.
The way you said that. Maybe when I grow up.
Alright, let's get into it.
Alright, we have to slap our hands. Rock, paper, scissors, shoot.
Paper.
Scissor. Rock, paper, scissors, shoot. Paper.
Rock.
Rock. Oh. Alright, I want you to go first.
Alrighty. My story is not fun.
Oh.
We're going to talk about a very terrible person today, and then at the end I'm going to rant a little bit about how people are terrible.
Okay.
It almost piggybacks on your story from last week. Have you ever heard of James Vaughn?
No.
No, you haven't.
I've heard of his brother, Vince.
Not related.
No relation.
Okay, so James Clayton Vaughn Jr. was the eldest son of James Clayton Vaughn Sr. and Helen Rowe Vaughn. He was born in Mobile, Alabama. Nope, I'm going to say that again. He was born in...
a bayou.
He's a bayou mummy.
He's a bog mummy.
Born in is it Mobile or Mobile?
Mm-hmm.
You just said, you didn't say which one it was.
What is it spelled?
Mobile.
And it's a place?
Mobile, Alabama.
I think it's Mobile.
All right. Born in Mobile, Alabama on April 13th, 1950, he had two sisters and a brother, and his father was a World War II vet turned butcher who would sporadically leave the family before returning and would... then eventually leave the family for good when James was only about 8 years old.
Okay, that's rough.
Yep, what a dick. His father was always abusive.
Oh.
And on his rare visits, it seemed to always have a beating accompanying it. Which at this point is like, bitch, just stay away.
Yeah, stop coming back.
His mother was a waitress and was described as a full-blooded German. She was really strict and perfectionist, and her abuse was never witnessed, but there was stories. They did grow up pretty poor as well, and James said he was rarely given enough to eat and suffered severe physical abuse, and it seemed like his mother didn't really care about any of her kids.
Okay, that's terrible. Why even have them?
I don't know. It was believed that in high school, James starts to show an interest in evangelical Christianity. The root of all evil. Just yeah. kidding.
No, okay, sorry.
Where am I? He was a member of the Church of God, headed by televangelist Garner Ted Armstrong, and visited nearly every church in the state that he could find. This high school kid. And religion, as we know, is the gateway drug to Nazism. He had memberships in the National Socialist White People's Party and the Ku Klux Klan, like a dirtbag. Anyway, at this point, he changed his name to Joseph Paul Franklin to honor Paul Joseph Goebbels, which was a German Nazi politician and one of Hitler's closest and most devoted associates. Did I say it wrong?
No, it's just so stupid to change your name to that.
Oh, but the Franklin part. Let's get to that.
Okay.
And also Benjamin Franklin, who we all know.
If you liked Benjamin Franklin, you're on notice.
We see you. At apparently just 10 years old, in 1960, Franklin was inspired by Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf to start a race war.
It's my struggle.
At 10 years old. That's your struggle? To start a race war?
No, Mein Kampf means my struggle in German.
Didn't know that. Sorry for calling you a Nazi.
Yeah, I'm like, okay.
Rude.
It's just funny that he named it that because, like, Hitler's struggling. Okay.
She's stupid.
Hitler's the victim here, I yep. guess.
Like every other white man. Anyway.
Do you need to say anything else? Like,
can we just end it here?
This is the one we get canceled for.
I feel like if you're into true crime, you get what we're saying.
Yeah.
He said, I've never felt that way about any other book that I read. It was something weird about that book.
And he's 10, right?
I don't think he was 10 when he said that.
Okay, but he was 10 when he was like, let me start a race.
Let me try. Yeah, exactly. In 1967, he decided to drop out of high school and avoided the draft due to poor eyesight. And at age 18, he married his 16-year-old neighbor, Bobby Louise Dorman, who he had only known for 2 weeks. She said, she had this to say. He was really kind and gentle at first. He said he was going to take care of me. And for a few weeks, it went okay.
A few weeks?
But then all of a sudden, he changed. Several times, he beat me so hard, I was afraid he was going to kill me.
Aww.
The couple divorced after 4 months, and Franklin married again under a fake identity years later.
Why?
In the early 70s, he started hanging around white supremacy groups.
Love it.
And he was studying racist literature and practicing Nazi salutes with sewn in swastikas into his clothes, and already had 2 tattoos, one of, guess what his tattoos were of.
Okay, one was, this is in America, right?
This is in America, yes.
Okay, so I want to say that one was a Confederate flag.
Okay.
And I want to say that the other one was a swastika.
Is that your final answer?
Yes.
Okay. So he had an American bald eagle.
Fuck, I was going to say bald eagle, but then I went definitely Confederate flag.
And a bloody grim reaper.
Oh, fuck. A bald eagle ripping through his skin. Yeah. That's such a thing.
With the flag underneath.
Yeah, with the flag. Yeah, and it looks like your skin is a flag.
Yep.
Idiot.
I mean, his ex-wife had said he had a lot of fantasies, and it was like James just wanted to belong to something different. I guess the Nazis were about as different as you could get.
Okay. They are built different.
Let's join a race group. Like, you're a dickbag.
Yeah.
At 20, in the early 1970s, Joseph was traveling around a lot. He did take a road trip to Virginia to an American Nazi party conference with David Duke, who was a student at the time, and Don Black. And if you don't know who David Duke is, he's a ball sack of a human.
Love it.
Who looks like a ball sack, had plastic surgery, and also an American neo-Nazi. He was anti-Semitic, he is a conspiracy theorist. He's a far-right politician, convicted felon, and former Grand Wizard of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan.
I knew I recognized that name. Is that Topher Grace?
I don't know.
From the Black Klansman?
I don't.
Did you see that movie?
I did see that movie.
That movie was
It's
good,
also based on a book.
But there was too many N-words in it for me.
It was like a Quentin Tarantino movie.
We have to say it for the story, do you? I mean, I know the Black Klansman's a different story, though. I just was watching it, like, at my house, and I was like, I have to turn this off. There's other people here. They think that I like this, and I don't like it.
Yeah, and so is Don Black. Same thing. So at this point, he's a part of the American Nazi Party, the KKK, and later the National States Right Party, and was pushing their pamphlet that promoted hate called The Thunderbolt. His descent into being a shitbag was swift. He was becoming emboldened by his racist convictions.
It was Topher Grace.
Oh, it's Topher Grace. Topher Grace. On Labor Day in 1976, he stalked an interracial couple and sprayed them with mace. But it wasn't until the following year when his hate started to take on a more violent nature. On July 25th, 1977, at 3:17 in the morning, a trunk load of dynamite was detonated outside the home of a Jewish pro-Israel lobbyist, Morris Amite, and his family. The home was severely damaged, but everyone inside escaped, except for the six-month-old beagle.
Aww!
Yeah. Asshole. 4 days later, on July 29th, 1977, the Beth Shalom Synagogue in Chattanooga was firebombed. No one was killed in this attack because some of the worshippers left earlier that evening. A few months later, on October 8th, 1977, Joseph hid in long grass behind a telegraph pole at Brith Shalom, a synagogue in Richmond Heights, Missouri, and fired into a group of worshippers with a hunting rifle, killing Gerald Gordon and injuring two others. So, armed with an arsenal of rifles and seething hatred, he moved from state to state, killing innocent people simply because of the color of their skin or religious heritage. He went undetected for a short while. He would switch between 18 aliases and frequently swapped vehicles, dyeing his hair and disguising himself. On March 6, 1978, he used a .44 caliber rifle and ambushed a Hustler publisher, which is a dirty magazine.
Yes.
Hustler publisher Larry Flint and his lawyer Gene Reeves in Lawrence, Georgia, in retaliation for an edition of Hustler that displayed interracial sex. He confessed to this, but was never charged.
Of course.
And in July 29th, 1978, he hid near a Pizza Hut in Chattanooga and shot and killed Brian Tatum with a 12-gauge shotgun. Brian was a black man, and Joseph also shot his white girlfriend, whom he was with, Nancy Hilton, who did survive. On July 12, 1979, Taco Bell manager Harold McCliver, a black man, was fatally shot through a window from 150 yards in Doraville, Georgia. Franklin confessed, but was not tried or sentenced for this crime. His reasoning, he said, that McCliver was too close in contact with the white woman, so he decided to murder him.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
On May 29th, 1980, Joseph, according to himself, shot and seriously wounded civil rights activist Urban League President Vernon Jordan after seeing him with a white woman in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He did initially deny any part in the crime and was acquitted, but did later confess. In June 8th, he's going on a killing spree. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you got that vibe.
Yeah, I can't tell why.
On June 8th, 1980, Joseph killed cousins Daryl Lane, 14, and Dante Evan Brown, 13, in Cincinnati, Ohio, waiting on an overpass to shoot a racially mixed couple. He shot the two kids instead. On June 15th, 1980, he shot and killed Arthur Smothers, 22, and Kathleen McCullough, 16, with a high-powered rifle as the couple walked across the Washington Street Bridge in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. Smothers was black and McCullough was white. On the day of the murder, Joseph took a position on a wooded hillside where he couldn't be seen and was overlooking downtown Johnstown, and waited for potential targets to enter his line of sight. He was never arrested for these murders. And on June 25th, 1980, Franklin was using a .44 Ruger pistol to kill two hitchhikers, Nancy Santomero, 19, and Vicky Duran, 26, in Poconos County, West Virginia. He confessed to the crimes in 1997 to an Ohio assistant prosecutor in the course of an investigation in another case.
Wow.
So he's definitely giving up fucking info like an asshole. Not an asshole, like a fucking idiot. If you can do crime, don't tell nobody you're doing crime.
Yeah.
He said he picked up the white women and decided to kill them after one said she had a black boyfriend.
Wow.
Jacob Beard of Florida was convicted and imprisoned in 1993 on these charges. So somebody else was basically went down for these. He was freed in 1999 and a new trial was ordered based on Franklin's confession. And on August 20th, 1980, Joseph killed two black men who were jogging along with two white classmates. The men, David Martin and Ted Fields, were son. Ted Fields was the son of a preacher, and they were in. They were near Liberty Park, located in Salt Lake City, Utah. That was just a spiel of his killing spree. There you go. That was his killing spree. Following his last attack in Utah, he did return to the Midwest, traveling through Kentucky. He was detained and questioned about a firearm he had had in his car. He was somehow able to get away from the interrogation.
Okay.
But not before authorities recovered enough evidence from the vehicle to now link him to the sniper killings that were happening all around this area. So, in October 1980, after 2 months of a manhunt for him, his tattoo drew the attention of a Florida blood bank worker who contacted the FBI and was arrested. He was arrested on October 28th in Lakeland, Florida. He tried to escape during the judgment of a 1997 Missouri trial on the charge of Gerald Gordon, whom he shot back in 1977, mm-hmm. when he fired into the group of worshippers outside of the synagogue. He obviously didn't get away and was convicted with the murder charge. And Dorothy Lewis, a psychiatrist who had interviewed him, testified for the defense that she believed he was a paranoid schizophrenic and unfit to stand trial. She noted his delusional thinking and childhood history of severe abuse. Doesn't mean you can go around killing people.
Yeah, what does that have to do with murdering
I think people that in a racist had, way? I think she had aligned her views with his. That's my thinking.
Oh.
So after his arrest, he did claim he killed at least 22 people during his murder spree. He confessed to the bombing on the two synagogues and 16 robberies and all the killings mentioned before.
Mm-hmm.
He then admitted to the attempted assassination of Vernon Jordan Jr., then president of the National Urban League and Hustler magazine publisher, the Larry Flint guy, who was paralyzed from the waist down as a result of the attack in 1978.
Mm-hmm.
However, even with all of this, the prosecution could only pin him to seven of his proclaimed murders, and he received a life sentencing with the death penalty from multiple states. He was held on death row at a correctional center near Mineral Point, Missouri, and in August 2013, the Missouri Supreme Court announced that Franklin had been executed on November 20th. A Missouri Attorney General Chris Koster said in a statement that by setting the execution date, the state high court has taken important steps to see that justice is finally done for the victims and their family. His execution was derailed for a few months due to the drug company that they use for lethal injections not wanting their drugs to basically be used to kill people.
Okay.
So they're like,
family unrelated.
Yeah. So that's why it kept getting pushed back. They're just like, we don't really want to be associated with that. Bitch, what do you think you're drugging for?
How did their drugs end up there?
I guess they're buying it in bulk or something. That's the only thing I can think of. His execution did begin at 6:07 a.m., and he was pronounced dead at 6:17 a.m. His execution was the first lethal injection in Missouri to use pentobarbital alone instead of the conventional three-drug cocktail that used to be used.
Mm-hmm.
He did not make any final written statements and did not speak a word in the death chamber. After the injection, he blinked a few times, breathed heavily a few times, swallowed hard, and the witness said the heaving of his chest slowed and finally stopped. All his victims varied. They had different socioeconomic statuses, ages, and genders, but they were all always black or Jewish,
mm-hmm.
except for the few scattered in there. A policeman from his hometown said, "This dude is very bad. I've seen a lot of life in my years on the force, but I'll never understand how a guy like this could happen." So even with his disguises and all his ploys to stay hidden, he made himself very obvious by spewing his hate and bullshit beliefs to anyone who would listen. He even one time tried to get a prostitute to tell him where all the black pimps hung out so he can go and basically try and kill them.
Wow.
He even tried to push the same prostitute into killing the bellhop at the motel that they were staying at, who just happened to be a black boy.
Wow.
In an interview with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch newspaper published on November 17, 2013, Joseph said he had renounced his racist views, and he said his motivation had been illogical and was partly a consequence of an abusive upbringing. He said he had interacted with black people in prison, adding, "I saw they were people just like us."
Wow. Big man.
Right? That statement says the exact opposite of what you're trying to say. Like, you could have worded that so much differently.
Mm-hmm.
And I got my information from allthat'sinteresting.com, Murderpedia, and Wikipedia. That is the story of the serial sniper killer James Vaughn.
Okay.
Or what did his name change to? Joseph Franklin. Joseph Paul Franklin. The trash bag of a human. They say
it all. Fuck that guy, though.
Yeah. So, that was my story. I thought it was fucking crazy.
I'm gonna say my stuff now.
Okay.
I got my information from Wikipedia, Reddit, meaww.com, history.com. That's it. Okay. I'm not even on the right page. Embarrassing. The missingest man in New York.
The missingest man.
The missingest man. A nickname I imagine you don't want to have.
No.
It would come later to Joseph F. Crater, who until then had gone by Joe, or Goo Time Joe.
Goo Time?
Goo Time Joe. No explanation given or needed. I don't need to know anything else.
Okay.
Goo Time Joe.
Goo Time.
Mr. Crater was born in 1889 and grew up following a hard-working path that truly culminated when he started working towards his law career. After becoming a clerk fresh out of college, he started teaching law classes at NYU, City of New York, and Fordham University. Being a lawyer wasn't the end of the line, though. He decided to go into politics. In 1920, he was brought on as New York Supreme Court Justice Robert F. Wagner's senior's secretary. 7 years later, he set up his own law firm, and 3 years after that, Governor Franklin D. Roosevelt appointed him to the state bench, surpassing the official candidate endorsed by the Tammany Hall political machine, known for its power as much as its corrupt ways. This only sparked rumors that Crater either paid off or had ties to the Tammany bosses, either option implying he was dirty. That year, he and his wife, Stella Wheeler, were summering in their cottage in Maine, but being busy with work, he had to make a few trips back to New York during their stay, leaving Stella there each time. On August 3rd, he took one such trip, promising Stella he'd be back before her birthday on the 9th. We don't know much about what he did or his whereabouts on those business trips leading up to the 6th, but on the 6th, we have a few accounts which piece together a pretty large portion of the puzzle. August 6th, we know he was in the office that morning because his clerk reported that he'd been there destroying a large sum of documents, as well as moving just as many portfolios of paper to his apartment on Fifth Avenue.
Wow, very suspicious.
Nothing weird about that.
How dare you imply that?
We also know that he arranged for $5,000 to be withdrawn from his bank account, which would be a whopping $78,746 in today's money, with the rate of inflation at 1,474,000.9%.
Okay.
Later that day, he bought a ticket to the Broadway comedy Dancing Partner and met friend slash fellow lawyer William Klein and a showgirl named Sally Lou Ritz.
I like that name.
Crater had a reputation for showgirls.
Oh.
With showgirls.
Oh.
For dinner at a Manhattan chop house. They disengaged after dinner where they saw Crater off as he walked down the street. This part is unclear because at first Klein testified that the judge got into a taxi cab outside the restaurant about 9:30 p.m. and drove west on 45th. Ritzy supported by saying, at the sidewalk, Judge Crater took a taxi cab. Later, they changed it to them getting in a cab and him walking off. In all I researched, I found no other sightings of him after that. However, we do know that no taxi cab picked him up that night. For a fact, we know. Because no taxi driver said they picked him up.
Okay.
It was not... Oh, and at the time, it was about, witnesses said that it was about 9:10 to 9:15 when he was leaving the restaurant, which would have been when the show was already happening that he bought a ticket to. Mm. It was not until September 3rd that it became public knowledge that he disappeared. This started a huge manhunt and investigation, which raised questions regarding his behavior in the days before his disappearance. At his wife's request, he was declared dead in 1939 after no leads arose. No real leads arose. Here's the description they put on his missing report. Caucasian male, gray and brown hair, brown eyes. Joseph wore a full set of dentures and wore tortoiseshell eyeglasses for reading. He had a tattoo of a Sigma Chi fraternity symbol on his arm. Joseph was balding and his hair was worn parted in the middle and slicked down in 1930. I don't know why the year is on there. The tip of his right index finger was deformed from being crushed. Around August 16th, his wife had started to become worried, even though he promised her he'd be back by the 9th. She sent her chauffeur into the city, but the chauffeur could not find him and said the apartment was in order. So she went to the city, finding the apartment to be in order. Everything was usual, but she also found the things, like all of his stuff was still there, but she also found things that he normally would have carried with him at the apartment. Mm-hmm. She files a missing report.
I just realized I got up and put my boob on the mic.
Did she? That's so funny. They did not start investigating until the 25th of August because they thought he would show up when the courts reopened. Hmm. Months later, his wife moves back to the Fifth Avenue apartment, and there she finds 4 envelopes filled with money in his bureau. Well, filled with checks of large sums of money in his bureau. One was signed and made payable to himself. 3 were for endorsed third parties. Another contained 4 of Crater's life policies, totaling $30,000 at the time, with Wheeler stated as the beneficiary. Mm-hmm. The third envelope contained Crater's will, which had been written in 1925, and stated that he left everything he owned to his wife. The fourth envelope contained a 3-page list in Crater's handwriting of people and companies who owed money to him and apparently intended for Wheeler because it was signed, "Love, Joe, this is all confidential."
Okay. Let's put it in the most least confidential area ever.
Yeah.
In a draw.
Yeah. Love you. Despite a thorough search of the house during investigations, the police had found nothing and had reason to believe that someone may have broken into the apartment to place the envelopes there sometime after the search was concluded.
Okay.
Oh, sorry, upon his death, it was revealed that he had association with several organized crime members and some suspicious financial dealings. His bank records showed that he'd withdrawn $20,000 at the time. At about the same time, he was appointed as the interim justice to the state Supreme Court. The amount was equivalent to his yearly salary at the time and was also considered the standard amount earned from Tammany Hall positions. His wife, Stella Wheeler, went on to remarry, divorce, and write a book about her life and her first husband's disappearance. It was called The Empty Robe.
Okay. Wait, her first husband? Did her second husband disappear?
I don't think so.
Because then it was the wife.
Well, it's always divorced. The wife. They divorced. I don't think you can divorce someone who disappears. You have to be married to them forever.
So they divorced before?
The second husband.
Oh, okay, yeah.
That one doesn't matter.
Yeah. The second husband doesn't matter?
Yeah, he doesn't matter.
Okay.
So, she married Good Time Joe when they were young. They met young.
Uh-huh.
And then they were married for, like, 20 years before he died, or went disappearing, or whatever the fuck.
He went disappearing.
Went disappearing, you know. Gone fishing. There were reportedly many sightings of him, none of which led to anything. The case was officially closed in 1985, which was 55 years after he disappeared.
How old was he when he went disappearing? He went disappearing.
I got you. He was 40, I believe. So he would have been 95. Also, it became a really big thing when he first went missing for people to, because he went missing so abruptly and was the missingest person, people would say, "You pulled a Crater." Oh, you pulled a Crater on me.
I like that. I think we start saying that.
Every time you, like, dip out, yeah. Or it'd be good because we could be like, "I'm about to pull a Crater," and then just fucking leave. That'd be good. We're going to have to start doing that. Oh, a breakthrough in his case came in 2005 when a 91-year-old woman named Stella Ferrucci Goods' relatives found an envelope marked, "Do not open until my death."
After Stella Ferrucci Goods?
Yes.
She sounds like a stripper.
A fun fucking person. You're right.
I mean,
she was 91, so I hope she could still bust it down.
She was like, "Check out my OnlyFans."
Hey, you want to see these cheeks clap, sunny boy? Okay. Do not open until my death. After she passed away in April. This is in 2005. In the letter, she implicated that three men in Crater's alleged murder were her husband, a Parks Department supervisor, and a lifeguard who died in 1975. Wait. Stop. Erase that.
Okay, how far?
She implicated three men in Crater's alleged murder. Her husband, who was a park department supervisor and lifeguard who died in 1975, a New York police officer, and the officer's brother who was a cab driver. It said that they'd killed him and buried his body in Coney Island, Brooklyn, under a boardwalk near West 8th Street, which is now the property where the New York Aquarium is.
Oh, wow, I know exactly where that is.
Yes. Unconfirmed reports state that skeletal remains of five people were found on the site in the 1950s when the aquarium was built, but they had been buried in a potter's field with thousands of other people's remains. What the fuck?
I like how you're reading that like you did write the story.
I'm reading this part off of my phone.
So, I guess that's, like, where they would keep, like, does and stuff like that.
But you'd think you'd want them to be, like... I don't know. It just sounds weird.
Well, when was that? The 1950s? Yeah, those fucking idiots.
Yeah, it's probably a big pile of bones.
It's just a big field where they throw bones.
Yeah.
That's very New York.
They probably didn't even fucking bury them.
You know what they did? They threw them on Staten Island.
Yeah, they did.
The forgotten dumpster burrow.
And then every 40 years, the skeletal remains form into a new person that lives on Staten Island.
It's me.
It's you.
I'm that person.
It's you.
I've come here to tell my story.
I'm here to tell my tale. I'm Bones Brianna. I'm Brianza. I'm Boniana.
Or what Bridget calls me, Beyonce.
Beyonce. So the thing
I'm
gonna
cut all that out.
With them doing the Coney Island thing, right? Like them burying him in Coney Island and then they dug it all up in the 1950s. This is before there was technology to, like...
That's what I mean. Those fucking idiots.
Yes!
Those boardwalks are so long. And they're wide as fuck. They're probably the whole width of this apartment.
There's probably millions of bodies under
There's
there.
There's definitely millions of bodies under there. It was like a fucking free-for-all in New York in the 70s and 80s.
That's fucking horrible.
Yeah.
They didn't DNA test the bodies because that didn't exist yet either. They couldn't identify the remains, and, they then didn't...
He didn't have any kids, right?
It didn't move any further. Yeah. He did not have any kids.
So even if they tested his DNA, it doesn't matter. Yeah, he doesn't have any family. Against? Unless he had, like, sisters that, and, or, you know, brothers that had kids.
Yeah. So...
Theories. Or nieces and nephews, what they're called.
That's true. theories are,
it's me.
They
Mario.
Said, some people said that Sally Lou Ritzy, Ritz or Ritzy, was his 22-year-old girlfriend. There are some people who think that he ran off with a girl, however, he
didn't left run, so much money.
Didn't run off with this girl. Also, it's like, did you run off in a hurry? You didn't bring any of your shit. If you're going to run off, you're going to do it in leisure, especially if you're an old white man who's got your shit set up.
And you got all this money. Are you going to take
it? Yeah, you can take your fucking money. He could have had other money out. I don't know if he left all that for his wife.
Must be nice to have all this money.
Up until his wife died, she would always go to a bar. I think that either the anniversary of his disappearance or on his birthday, she would go to the same bar every year. She would order two drinks, and she would cheers, and she would say to Joe, wherever you may be, or whatever the fuck. And she was just, oh, she said, good luck, wherever you may be. And then she would drink one of the drinks.
Okay.
Like, the second drink was for him.
Yeah, yeah.
I just thought that was sweet, especially because the biggest theory is that he ran away with a girl.
Oh, yeah, fuck him.
Yeah.
If that's the theory, then fuck him.
Yeah.
Because I'd be like, fuck you, Joe Goo. Or whatever your name
goo
is.
Goo time, Joe.
Goo time, Joe.
It's goo time.
Fucking dickbag.
It's clobbering time.
It's clobbering
time. So at the time, New York City was an extremely corrupt city.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
And he had a mob connection because of Tammany Hall, which was like organized crime, basically. So they think that he maybe got wrong with someone, you know. They also theorize that Sally was killed too, which I didn't see anything else about Sally. So not long after his disappearance, Sally also disappeared.
Wow.
Yeah. So in May 2014, Ariel Lawhon, who is an author, got an email. He'd written a book about Crater's disappearance. He talked about Sally Ritz a lot, and he believed that Sally had died in the autumn of that year, 1930. So his email was from an older woman who said that the woman in his book was her grandmother, and that she most definitely didn't die. She'd changed her name and left New York City for California, married, had a child, and then grandchildren. She didn't talk a lot about her personal life. They didn't know anything about her being Sally Ritz. She died in 2000, around 92. So a lot of people are questioning why she left at that exact time when he went missing to California, changed her name, and then never told anybody who she was. There's possible that people think that she was scared, so she was running because she got involved in whatever happened with him. Unfortunately, since she didn't tell anybody anything, we won't ever know that end of the story. But the good thing is that she did live, apparently, a really great life, because everyone thought she was dead until then.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
And a lot of people think that she is the literal answer to what happened, just because she went missing for so long. I think my biggest question is, aside from, like, what did Sally know?
Huh? Besides, where the fuck did he go?
Yeah, well, where did he go? But what did Sally know? Is it possible that they killed him? And also, if he promised his wife he would be home before the 9th, why didn't she go looking for him until the 16th?
Because she killed him.
Do you think?
I think.
It's very possible it was a mob thing just because he was destroying all that paperwork. Which that's I would assume true. Is evidence. And then he took a bunch to his house, which they didn't find.
For the time, it makes sense.
Yeah.
For
dirty.
Sure.
Dirty. Dirty. Yeah.
Definitely. For the time, it makes sense that it'd be a mob hit.
Yeah. And that's my whole story.
And that's the tea.
That's the tea.
And that's on disappearance.
And that's,
it's the disappearance for me.
Fuck you! I was just gonna say that! That's the disappearance for me. Wow. Well, tell your dad, tell your mom about this podcast.
You won't regret it.
You won't regret telling them. Unless you do. We say some pretty fucked up stuff. We say some pretty gross, heinous, nasty little shit.
Just go out into the world, guys.
Scream it on your rooftop.
Don't be an asshole. Yeah. Be nice to people. It's not that fucking hard.
Yeah. And you know what? If you see someone else that's being an asshole, fucking stop them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wear your mask.
Wear your mask.
Don't be a dickbag.
Yeah.
And go forth and make the best of the world.
Yes. Go forth and don't steal anybody's.
Wrong episode.
Just think that's the best advice we've ever given, honestly. I left in that one episode when I was like, I have a controversial stance. And you were like, no, I don't agree. And you didn't let me say it. And I said, I don't think you should kill your families. I said, I don't think you should kill families. But you had already said you didn't agree. And I was like, wow, really? You want to kill families so
you should
bad.
Kill your
you should kill families.
Okay.
Okay, follow us on Instagram and Twitter at
Gumshoe Weekly.
And Facebook at
Gumshoe Pod.
And you can email us suggestions at
gumshoeweekly@gmail.com.
Bye! Bye.